Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Got my mojo working, but just don't work on you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about how exercise can help control blood glucose and trim your waist size and body fat. And if you're diabetic, it's extra good for you. And the emotional brains are physically different to rational brains. And a new study finds benefit for ubiquinol, that's coenzyme Q10, in Parkinson's disease, and carotenoids lower lipid oxidation and DNA damage in middle-aged men, and a lot more on health and healing. Then, from Martha Rosenberg from Alternet, 7 giant lies about red meat promoted by the meat industry. And because we just finished a film showing you how bad the animal was treated, and each day I'm putting up on my own website and my Facebook descriptions of how they're still eating meat all over China and Indonesia and Korea. And until you see this, and many of these cats and dogs are skinned alive, boiled alive, and you see the people enjoying it. And so I believe that we have to start a campaign to show them why they shouldn't be doing this. So I'm going to get to that whole idea of meat lies, and that was also covered substantially in the new film Saving the Planet. Also today, an in-depth discussion on how America has become an authoritarian police state. Today, when I look at our body politic, the control of our state legislatures by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, how a minimum of 22,000, some believe as high as 30,000 laws have been written by corporate interest, their lobbyists, their lawyers, and then given to state legislators to pass. We're now seeing this in California and all other states, even in New York State. There is now, just today, a new bill in New York State that has gone through the assembly that would mandate another vaccine for children, as if there was any science supporting the original ones. So when I see how the police are treating civilians compared to how historically they would have, the racial profiling, the prison system, the privatization of debtors' prisons, the profiteering off debt, taking advantage of those who are most at risk of insolvency or who are destitute, and then you can charge them 1,000% interest on a payday loan. And then you see that in Texas, the head of the committee that oversees payday loans owns a payday loan. It's just the whole body politic is corrupted. So today, a very comprehensive conversation on Orwell, Huxley, and America's plunge into authoritarianism. Professor Henry Giroux, Counterpunch. You won't want to miss that. If time permits, an in-depth discussion, if not on this show, the next show on the industrial agriculture is a major threat to world food supply. And also laws to shut people up on animal abuse. They're now being used to cover up daycare and nursing home abuse. So now they want to make it against the law. If you work in a nursing home or visit one or have a relative and you see something is wrong and you want to tell someone that there's something wrong, they want you to go to jail. This is all part of this corporatized, commodified, and yet the vast majority of Americans are intentionally ignorant. They're not stupid, but they're intentionally ignorant. They don't want to know about this because it's not happening to them. Let's begin because we have a lot to share. I believe that exercise is one of the single most important things for our total health, and all their studies have proven this. And this is just one more. This is from the University of Texas, and it says the following. Diabetics who exercise can trim waist fat and body fat and control blood glucose even if they don't see cardiorespiratory benefits. This is from University of Texas Southwest Medical Center cardiologists. So, quote, we observe that exercise improves diabetics control regardless of improvements in exercise capacity. So if you just start exercising, and I suggest power walking or swimming, or it's okay to do spinning, but not the way it's done. Put it at your highest resistance so you really have to stress your legs and your body and your breathing to get that benefit. And then you'll start to see that you'll have a better control of your blood sugar, you'll start to lose weight, your muscles will tighten up. All good if you're diabetic. And this is published in the peer-reviewed journal Diabetes Care. Now, some good news for those of you who have been using coenzyme Q10, also known by ubiquinol. According to Gentido University in Japan, published in Parkinsonian and Related Disorders, they looked at coenzyme Q10 in men and women with Parkinson's and found improvement among a group of subjects experiencing a return to symptoms that occurred when treating the disease with levodopa, which indicates need for adjustment of the dosage, change medication. So, better than a drug, coenzyme Q10. And that was just using 300 milligrams compared to a placebo. You really want to help people, you got to go much higher than that if they have Parkinson's. And finally, the carotenoids lowered lipid oxidation and DNA damage in middle-aged men. This is from Federal University in Brazil. And here's what they say. Daily carotenoid intake lowered lipid, that's your fats, and oxidative stress, that's your free radicals that are created by oxidative stress in middle-aged men. The study looked at nearly 300 middle-aged men, average age 50, and a body mass of 25% body fat, and they found that the carotenoids, that means your colorful fruits and vegetables, the more that they had, the lower their damage from lipid and DNA damage. So the more DNA damage you have, the more susceptible you are to cancer and disease and shortening of your lifespan. So if you want to live a longer life, protect your DNA, and the carotenoids can help do that. So that's the latest on health and nutrition. We're going to take a brief break and come back. We have a lot to share. Please stay with us. Have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting from our studios in New York City, and have a really comprehensive commentary to give in just a few moments. But I'm working towards the goal of, in about 3 months, having a national walk, a march against meat. And I'm working on it now with a group of teenagers, because they're the ones most likely to be out there and to do this. And we're always told, but if you gave up meat, you would end up, you know, puny. Well, not true. So Martha Rosenberg of Alternet put together 7 big lies about red meat, and I'll share these with you. Lie number 1, there is no science linking red meat to cancer, stroke, and heart attacks. Now, that's the meat industry's story. And just like big tobacco, maintaining cigarettes' safety until the bitter end, or GMOs, saying GMOs are safe, the North American Meat Institute calls the new guidelines flawed and nonsensical and cites inconsistencies in links between red meat and health problems in a 44-page rebuttal to the new guidelines. Yet, here's what I found and you can find. Search under red meat on the U.S. National Library of Medicine website, and you'll find the first thing pops up, cancer. There's 1,065 research articles on that. Then the third search term is for colorectal cancer, where there are 452 research entries. And other top search choices include cardiovascular disease, heart disease, breast cancer, diabetes, and red meat consumption and death. And the first entries on the American Heart Association's website under red meat are for articles called, quote, "Eat More Chicken, Fish, and Beans. Processed red meat linked to higher risk of heart failure and death. Choosing healthier protein-rich foods instead of red and processed meat." That's from the American Cancer Heart Association. The American Cancer Society says, quote, "Because of a wealth of studies linking colon cancer to diet-high red meats, beef, lamb, and pork, and processed meats, hot dogs, bologna, etc., the society encourages people to eat more vegetables and fish and less red and processed meats." Okay, so we have all the studies on our side showing that meat causes heart disease and cancers and high blood pressure. How many studies do they have, not sponsored by them, but independent studies that shows that eating red meat or processed meats allows you to live a longer life or prevents heart disease or cancer? How about zero? Lie number two, meat today is leaner than it used to be and better for you. That sounds convincing to a lot of people. Well, it's trouble is it's not true. And the fat content of lean red meat has reduced substantially over the past few decades, they say. A change in farming methods and butchery techniques now means that lean beef contains as little as 5% fat and lean pork 4% and lamb 8%. But these are pro-red meat websites. And the North American Meat Institute even goes so far as to say that ham and processed meats, quote, can be lean. Well, there's another risk from meat fat, which is especially prevalent during barbecue season. Dripping fat creates carcinogens called heterocyclic amines and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. And even when red meat is lean, it can still be a heart risk and a cancer risk. In fact, increasingly, two components found in meat, what is called a trimethylamine N-oxide and NU5GC, are viewed as key mechanisms that drives the heart risk through causing inflammation in your artery walls. So what do we have on our side? Multiple studies showing that heterocyclic amines, and if you just Google hetero, H-E-T-E-R-O, cyclic, C-Y-C-L-I-C, heterocyclic amines, you'll find all these studies. On their side, showing that lean meat is healthy, zero. Number three, meat is an ideal protein because it's nutrient dense. Well, it's got a lot of protein, yes. Has some iron, yes. But in point of fact, vegetables have more. They have more B complex and vitamin C, and they have the polyphenols and quercetin. And fibers, meat doesn't have any of that. So, in point of fact, nuts and legumes are dense and provide satiety. You have a handful of nuts and some seeds, sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, it can kill the appetite, but gives you nutrients. Line number four, the salt in meat is good for you. Really? The North American Meat Institute admits that salt, quote, plays a critical role in the production of meat products, especially processed meat. But rather than acknowledge the role of excessive salt in high blood pressure, heart attacks and failure, and stroke and damage to the kidneys and blood vessels, they think salt's a good thing. Well, they can think that all they want. The science shows just the opposite, that the higher the meat is in salt, either while cooking it or after it's cooked, and in the processing process, the greater the task of your kidneys to eliminate it and the thickening up of your blood, you really put yourself at risk of a stroke. Also, preservatives like salt, keep meat safe from growing germs like Listeria and Salmonella and E. coli, but that is not the case. Millions of Americans can't be wrong, they say. Well, the fact that a lot of Americans do something doesn't mean that it's right. I don't think I need to comment any more on that. After all, we voted for 7 straight presidents who had the total cumulative IQ, I think, of Bugs Bunny. But Bugs wasn't dangerous to us. So the fact that we do a lot of things doesn't mean that it's right. And lastly, red meat warnings violate consumer rights. Oh, you mean you feel offended because someone's trying to explain to you that there could be a problem with what you're eating? Well, we need to know if our meat contains GMOs and what's in our meat. And I think that's just common sense. So those are some of the lies about red meat, and hopefully more and more Americans will stop eating it. By the way, the American Medical Association has now gone after anyone who is challenging the orthodoxy of the AMA. They're once again going after the quack MDs. Now, I thought they were stopped from doing this a long time ago, and for a moment in time they were, but now they're preparing gag orders for medical dissenters. That means that we're going to revert back 30 years when doctors could be brought up on charges of practicing unscientific medicine if they used anything considered complementary or natural in their practice. And so that means they're also going to go after chiropractors again. They didn't seem to learn the first lesson, and I was responsible for doing 2 major articles and releasing a lot of documents that brought the AMA into court. They lost, by the way, clear up to the Supreme Court. They had to pay a massive fine, as did the 12 largest medical organizations in America. So AMA, we're preparing another challenge coming at you, and you will see it shortly. Didn't get the first message? Maybe the second one will wake you up, because we intend to take you back to court. Now, also, I want to share this, that there's something new out there, and that is laws to shut people up on animal abuse now being used to cover up daycare and nursing home abuse. From John Vibes, quote, first they came for the animal rights activist. A recent report pointed out that laws which are used to prevent animal rights activists from exposing inhumane practices at factory farms can also be used to prevent whistleblowers that attempt to expose corruption at other facilities like daycare centers or nursing homes. The controversial ag-gag laws do not just apply to factory farms, but are written so broadly they can prevent people from speaking out against unethical practices that are happening in their places of business. In a statement earlier this year, AARP criticized a newly proposed ag-gag bill in North Carolina, stating that it will prevent nursing home employees from speaking out about unethical practice in the workplace. Quote, House Bill 405 will create new risks for workers, older adults, families, and children because it extends to all industries, including nursing homes, hospitals, group homes, medical practices, charter and private schools, and daycare centers. So, it looks like they don't want anyone talking about any crimes or misdemeanors or any abusive practices anywhere that affects a corporation's profits. And they're using the ag-gag bills as ways of doing it. Who's behind all this? The American Legislative Exchange Council, and next week I'll be doing a major expose on them. I'm Gary Knoll. Now let's, before we get into this heavy topic in a moment, let's hear from a person who feels, well, do you want to be more spiritual?
How are you? I'm JP Sears. I would like to share with you 10 tips to ruin your life so that you can be certain that your life is going to be ruined the way you want it to be. Tip 1, never take risks. Because you might fail, and if you fail once, your life is over. There's nothing to be learned from mistakes. Tip 2, seek other people's approval. So tell me, what do you like about me? I just want you to like me. What should I change about me? I'll do anything. Please tell me, I'll change anything for you to like me. Tip 3, talk about things but take no action.
Dude, we should totally start a business. We could form a band. I'm thinking about changing jobs. I might move out of my parents' house.
Do you really want to do that?
Nah, I'm good.
Tip 4, value things and use people.
Because you can't buy things with people. Good night, sweetheart.
Tip 5. Conceal your emotions.
Don't be sad. There's no reason for you to feel sad or feel anything. Tighten up and toughen up.
Tip number 6, be normal.
Don't be mistaken in believing you're on this planet to be a unique individual. You are here to be like everybody else.
Number 7, keep secrets.
Always hide everything about you from other people. It's safer that way.
Tip 8, never work hard.
The good things in life can be done from the couch. I'm on my A game today.
Number 9, ignore your intuition.
What did listening to your gifts, inner wisdom, and purpose ever do for anyone? No one can guarantee you it's right, so trash it.
Tip 10, avoid personal responsibility.
Mom, I just found out I have about $20,000 worth of credit card debt, and this is all your fault, because you were a crappy mother.
These tips are guaranteed to ruin your life.
I hope you've had fun with me today. If you're not into ruining your life, I hope you can let these tips be a guide on how not to live life, so that you can live the fulfilling life that you desire.
Be sure to subscribe to my channel. New videos every week.
And those, of course, were written by the editorial and management staff of our sister station, KPFA, in Berkeley. And they actually live by them. Now, for those of you who are concerned about water, and we did have a water crisis, are having a water crisis in the United States, but in some places it got so bad, like in Detroit, that we started turning people's water off if they couldn't pay for it. Now, we didn't care what happened to them. And in Detroit, you heard about it, but you really didn't hear about it outside of Detroit. Well, what happens when they tell the Irish something has been free your whole life, what comes out of the tap water, is not free. We're going to water tax you. Now, we're not going to tax corporations because we got to take your water taxes and pay back the corporations who we borrow money from. So here's what Russell Brand has to say about when people decide in the Republic of Ireland that they don't want water being taxed, and they as a country stand up and hundreds of thousands of people protest in Dublin, in just one city, and why we can't do the same thing in the United States.
Welcome to the Truths. Truths is true news. Subscribe here to the Truths. Ah, I'm up for the crack. Top of the morning to you. Jesus, this water's awful. Today we are talking about the water meter situation in Ireland, and I'm doing the first prop joke in the history of the Truths.
It rains a lot in Ireland, so there's no shortage of water.
Stupid, childish beginning.
But there's been a drought of investment for decades.
Why are there so many puns? There's no shortage of water, but there's been a drought of investment. People are getting wet with money. Oh, sorry, I don't know.
And it's water infrastructure, meaning some areas don't have a supply fit to drink.
Ireland has plenty of fresh water.
Who's this clown?
Ireland has plenty of fresh water.
Ireland's got plenty of fresh water. And I've been skipping about in it all morning with a couple of fine Irish fellas. Haven't they, boys? Get your fucking hands off me.
People have to boil their tap water before they can drink it. That's because it contains a bacteria which makes it unfit for human consumption.
We've had a lot of people telling us about this water crisis in Ireland. The government have employed a private firm to install water meters in people's homes, and a third of Irish people are burning their contracts.
Ireland needs to invest huge sums of money to bring its water treatment infrastructure up to scratch. But plans to bring in a water tax to do so are proving to be an austerity measure that's just a little too much to swallow.
That's enough puns out of you, mate. Have the Irish people not always paid for water through taxes? Yes. It costs in excess of $1 billion to maintain the Irish water supply, and over the last 3 decades that money has been provided out of the general exchequer. Oh, raising money from water charges was a condition as part of the country's bailout in 2010 following the economic collapse. So when they did that bailout, they went, right, well, we've got to bail these banks out, obviously. how can we provide some extra revenue? How about charging people for their most basic rights like water? Oh, haven't they already paid for that? Oh, yeah, they've already paid for it. What, are we going to make them pay again? Yes.
Water was paid from general taxes before, but the plan to charge homes individually has brought protest.
From the river to the sea!
Irish water will be free!
Because the Irish people have been used to having a kick-off against Britain for years, when there's a protest required, they can organise it well. Proper songs. From the water to the sea, Irish water will be free! Yes, it's quite good, this water crisis, and it's got a really good atmosphere. So one of the obvious observations that can be made is how come that Ireland is continuing to provide massive tax breaks to huge companies when there's an infrastructure crisis in their nation? Ireland offers international corporations such as Apple, Facebook, Amazon and Google a loophole, I think it's called the Double Irish, that helps multinational corporations legally dodge billions of dollars of taxes in their homelands. Remember, $2 billion would solve this war crisis.
Bills will range from over $200 a year for a single person to more than $600 for a family of four adults.
What are these different currencies that are going on? Euros, dollars, pounds, and it'll be 544 shamrockarooros.
The latest austerity charges are proving hard for some to swallow.
Irish water will be free!
Obviously, what people say is the tax breaks that are offered to big companies... it's not an option to change that because that's what makes the Irish economy so stable. But the Irish economy isn't stable. Look, one in four Irish people endure social deprivation, according to the state's own Central Statistic Office. Obviously, there's this massive infrastructural crisis. And over and across the whole EU, €1 trillion is lost to tax dodging. So just from tax dodging and tax avoidance schemes, $1 trillion could be put back into state infrastructure. Doesn't that seem like a solution to you, rather than going back to the public? People the worst hit by the economic crisis continue to pay the biggest price.
At the moment, there's so many people in Ireland that can't even pay their mortgage. How are you going to pay for water?
I don't think the government realises.
They do realise.
So there it is. Major corporations are going to Ireland, where they won't have to pay taxes for products in the United States, or their corporate profits in the United States. They're dodging over $1 trillion a year, and the entire water infrastructure could be upgraded and improved and made healthier with $2 billion. So corporations should pay that. They already have paid $1 billion a year from the taxpayers, so the taxpayers could pay it. But they're giving that money to corporations, and that's why the people are protesting. As you heard Russell Brand just say, one in four people in Ireland are seeking or in need of public assistance. And so they're really hurt over there. Just to show you how other countries deal with issues. Now, if all Americans join in solidarity with the people of Detroit and tens of thousands had their water turned off, then we would make it an issue. And we would be able to help those people and get their water turned back on. Water is a human right and should not be privatized. In spite of their differing perceptions of the architecture of the totalitarian superstate and how it exercised power and control over its residents, George Orwell and Aldous Huxley shared a fundamental conviction. They both argued that the established democracies of the West were moving quickly towards a historical moment when they would willingly relinquish the noble promises and ideals of liberal democracy and enter the menacing space where totalitarianism perverts the modern ideals of justice, freedom, political emancipation. Both believed that Western democracies were devolving into pathological states in which politics was recognized in the interests of death over life and justice. Both were unequivocal in the shared understanding that the future of civilization was on the verge of total domination of what was once called the Dark Times. It is my belief that we are now in the Dark Times, but not if you live on the Upper West Side, not if you live on the Far East Side, not if you live in any one of about 500 very affluent gated communities, not if you're on many of the college campuses and you're tenured and or you're provided with a nice benefit for teaching or being there. But what if you're an indebted student? What if you're the student's indebted parents? What if you're a person working two or three jobs? What if you're one of the 245 million Americans who are now at poverty's door or locked inside of the cages of poverty in debtors' prisons? Then it's a different reality. I'd like to share what Henry Juro has to say on this. And while Neil Postman and other critical dissidents have pitted Orwell and Huxley against each other, and I just played Aldous Huxley's 1958 interview with Mike Wallace just, I think, 2 weeks ago, and a lot of people responded that they appreciated hearing someone who was such a critical thinker talking about things in 1958 that are relevant today. What we have is, I believe, the dark shadow of authoritarianism that shrouds American society like a thick veil that can be lifted by reexamining Orwell's prescient dystopian fable 1984, as well as Huxley's Brave New World, in light of contemporary neoliberal ascendancy. Now, rather than pit their dystopian visions against each other, it might be more productive to see them as complementing each other, especially at a time when, to quote Antonio Gramsci, the old world is dying and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. Both authors provide insights into the merging of the totalitarian elements that constitute a new and more hybridized form of authoritarian control, appearing less as fiction than a threatening portend of the unfolding 21st century. Consumer fantasies and authoritarian control, Big Brother intelligence agencies, and the voracious seductions of privatized pleasures, along with the rise of the punishing state, which criminalizes an increasing number of behaviors and invest in institutions that incarcerate and are organized principally for the production of violence and the collapse of democratic public spheres into narrow market-driven orbits of privatization. These, in my opinion, now constitute the new order of authoritarianism. Orwell's Big Brother found more recently a new incarnation in the revelations of government lawlessness and corporate spying by whistleblowers such as Chelsea Manning and Jeremy Hammond and Edward Snowden. All of these individuals revealed a government that lied about its intelligence operations, illegally spied on millions of people who were not considered terrorists or had committed any crime, and collected data from every conceivable electronic source to be stored and potentially used to squelch dissent, blackmail people, or just intimidate those who fight to make corporate and state power accountable. Orwell offered his readers an image of the modern state in which privacy was no longer valued as a civil virtue and as a basic human right, nor perceived as a measure of the robust strength of a healthy and thriving democracy. In Orwell's dystopia, the right to privacy had come under egregious assault, but the ruthless transgressions of privacy pointed to something more sinister than the violation of individual rights. The claim to privacy for Orwell represented a moral and political principle by which to assess the nature, power, and severity of an emerging totalitarian state. Orwell's warning was intended to shed light on the horrors of totalitarianism, the corruption of language, the production of a pervasive stupidity, and the endless regimes of state spying imposed on citizens in the mid-20th century. Orwell opened a door for all to see a nightmarish future in which everyday life becomes harsh, an object of state surveillance and control, a society in which the slogan "ignorance becomes strength" morphs into a guiding principle of mainstream media, education, and the culture of politics. Huxley shared Orwell's concern about ignorance as a political tool of the elite, enforced through surveillance and the banning of books, dissent, critical thought itself. But Huxley believed that social control and the propagation of ignorance would be introduced by those in power through the political tools of pleasure and distraction. Huxley thought this might take place through drugs and genetic engineering, but the real drugs and social planning of late lies in the presence of an entertainment and public power industry that trades in pleasure and idiocy, most evident in the merging of neoliberalism, celebrity culture, and the control of commanding cultural apparatuses extending from Hollywood movies and video games to mainstream television news and social media. Orwell's Big Brother of 1984 has been upgraded in 2015, and as Zygmunt Bauman pointed out, if the older Big Brother presided over traditional enclosures such as military barracks and prisons and schools, countless other big and small would be a part of this mix, so that there would be an inclusion into every part of our life, including life and death. Keeping people out of the truth is the extended face of the Big Brother today. Let them know no truth except what it offers. And now they patrol our borders, they patrol our hospitals, they patrol virtually all public spaces in order to locate the person who does not fit in, and then banish them from the place and departing them to where they belong. And it could not be any clearer when you have free-form radio, or supposedly free speech radio, where you delegate individuals to the category of deniers simply because it does not conform with your ideology. So even in the so-called liberal media, including The Nation magazine and Mother Jones and MSNBC and Pacifica, you see this same overarching political dynamic at play. This is the Big Brother. They are all accomplices with Big Brother that pushes youthful protests out of the public spaces they attempt to occupy, or critical thinkers, or those who are more spiritually aligned, and instead put who they believe should be in that space. This is the Big Brother whose split personality portends the dark authoritarian universe of the 1% with their control over the economy and use of paramilitarized police forces on the one hand, and on the other hand, they retreat into gated communities manned by SWAT-like security forces, or into foundations that promise there'll be a cure for AIDS or a cure for cancer or a cure for whatever else is, providing that you pay for their multi-million dollar office overhead. Was it not the American Red Cross that raised $500 million to build over 120,000 living spaces for people in Haiti and to date has built exactly six residences? Six. And yet no one criticizes them. And tomorrow they'll be back at making more money and exploiting it to pay for what they want to pay for, but it's not helping people. The increasing militarization of local police forces, who are now armed with weapons from the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan, has transformed how the police respond to dealing with the public. Cops have been transformed into soldiers, just as dialogue and community policing have been replaced by military-style practices that are way out of proportion to the crimes the police are trained to address. For instance, in The Economist reported, quote, SWAT teams were deployed about 3,000 times in 1980, but are now used over 50,000 times a year. Some cities use them for routine patrols in high-crime areas. Baltimore and Dallas have used them to break up poker games. In 2010, New Haven, Connecticut used a SWAT team to send to a bar suspected of serving underage drinkers. That same year, heavily armed police raided barber shops around Orlando, Florida, they said were hunting for guns and drugs, but ended up arresting 34 people for barbering without a license. Maricopa County, Arizona, sent a SWAT team into a living room of a person who was suspected of organizing cockfights, end quote. In the advent of the recent display of police force in Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore, Maryland, it is unfair to view the impact of the rapid militarization of local police on poor black communities as nothing short of terrifying and symptomatic of the violence that takes place in authoritarian societies. For instance, according to a recent report produced by Malcolm X Grassroots Movement entitled Operation Ghetto Storm, quote, police officers, security guards, or self-appointed vigilantes extrajudicially killed at least 313 African Americans in 2012 alone. This means a black person was killed by a security officer every 28 hours. Why? Fear and isolation constitute an updated version of Big Brother. Fear is managed and it is buttressed by a neoliberal logic that embraces the notion that while fear be accepted as a general condition of society, how it is dealt with by members of the American public be relegated to the realm of the private, dealt with exclusively as an individual consideration, largely removed from the collapse of authoritarian control and democratic rule, and posited onto the individual's fear of the other. In the surveillance state, fear is misplaced from the political sphere and emergence of an authoritarian government to the personal concern of the fear of surviving, not getting ahead, unemployment, and the danger posed by the growing legions of the other. As the older order dies, a new one struggles to be born. Yes, and that is what we are faced with. And what we have is now the rise of the social monster, all too willing to kidnap, torture, and spy on law-abiding citizens while violating civil liberties. As Antonio Gramsci once suggested, such a group offers no political guarantees, but it does provide, or at least gestures towards the conditions that what is to be done, how it might be done, and who is willing to do it. Orwell's 1984 continues to serve as a brilliant and important metaphor for mapping the expansive trajectory of global surveillance. Authoritarianism and the suppression of dissent that has characterized the first decades of the new millennium. The older modes of surveillance to which Orwell pointed, including his warnings regarding the dangers of microphones and giant telescreens that watch and listen, are surprisingly limited when compared to the varied means now available of spying. They actually have something they introduced this week. It's as small as a mosquito, and yet it has cameras on it. It can fly into your house. And while you're asleep, it can actually take a sample of your DNA. You won't feel it. It will see you. It will take your blood and fly back. All the while, it can monitor anything said or done. And yet we consider this the new norm. It does not astonish us. Yet Orwell would be astonished by this contemporary, refashioned Big Brother, given the threat the new surveillance state poses because of its reach and the alleged advance of technology that far outstretched anything he could have imagined. Technologies that pose a much greater threat to both the personal privacy of citizens and the control exercised by sovereign power. In spite of his vivid imagination, Orwell never could have imagined that the National Security Agency would amass metadata on billions of our phone calls and 200 million of our text messages every single day. Orwell could not have foreseen that our government would read the content of our emails, file transfers, and live chats from the social media we use. Edward Snowden and other critics are correct about the dangers of the state infringement of privacy rights, but their analysis should be taken further by linking the issue of citizen surveillance with the rise of networked societies, global flow of power, and the emergence of a totalitarian ethos that defies even state-based control. For Orwell, domination was state-imposed and bore the heavy hand of unremitting repression and a smothering language that eviscerated any appearance of dissent, erased historical memory, and turned the truth into its opposite. For Orwell, individual freedom was at risk under the heavy hand of state terrorism. And yet, take a moment and pause. Let us just turn around and look at our history. How did we get into the Vietnam War? And what were the consequences to those who misguided us and misled us and lied to us and the false flag of the Tonkin Gulf incident? And what about those who got us into Iraq and the consequence to those in the Middle East and Americans? And what price did they pay? Nothing. And those, including on Pacifica, who advocated the overthrow of Gaddafi and going into Libya, have they gone to Libya today? Why don't they do a live broadcast from Libya today, since they advocated going in? And how about with Syria? the people who have been the policymakers and opinion leaders, both in the media and in the state capitals and the national capital, and in the controlling so much of the corporate footprint that's on all this, have never paid a single price to their reputations or to their power. In Orwell's world, individual freedom and privacy were under attack from outside forces. For Huxley, in contrast, freedom and privacy were willingly given up as part of the seduction of a soft authoritarianism with its vast machinery of manufactured needs, desires, and identities. This new mode of persuasion seduced people into chasing commodities and infantilized them through the mass production of easily digestible entertainment and disposable goods and new scientific advances in which any viable sense of agency was undermined. The conditions for critical thought dissolved into the limited pleasures instant gratification wrought through the use of technologies and consuming. The very possibility of thinking itself was challenged. And look at an entire generation of people today, the baby boomers, who refuse to use their critical judgment and all their knowledge for a new round of critical thinking and social activation. They are asleep. And look at the young people. With some exceptions, they are part of not one altered worldview, Orwell's, but certainly of Huxley's. Take the drugs and have an altered state of reality. Orwell warns that we will be overcome by an externally imposed oppression. But in Huxley's version, no big brothers required to deprive people of their autonomy, maturity, and history. As he saw it, people will come to love their oppression, to adore the technologies that undo their capacities to think. For Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared was there would be no reason to ban a book, for there would be no one who would want to read one. Today, the average person graduating from high school will only read one book the rest of their life. The average person graduating from college will only read three nonfiction books the rest of their life. Orwell feared that those who deprive us of information would be the enemy. Huxley feared those who would give us so much information that we would be reduced to passivity and egotism. Orwell feared that the truth would conceal from us. Huxley feared the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared we would become a captive culture. As Huxley remarked in Brave New World Revisited, the civil libertarians and rationalists who are ever on the alert to oppose tyranny fail to take into account man's almost infinite appetite for distractions. In 1984, Huxley added, people are controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they are controlled by inflicting pleasure. In short, Orwell feared that we would hate that which ruins us. Huxley feared that we will love that which will ruin us. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Also look forward to being in Woodstock tomorrow, 7 p.m., the show Saving the Planet. Have a nice day, everyone.